The unusual media personalities who have been chosen to front the new Stand Up to Hate campaign.
That's in 30 minutes on ABC Radio National with me, Tim Burrows.
And me, Vivian Kelly. Catch you then.
ABC News, I'm Eliza Getzey. People from across the country have filed from the street to the pub, from Anzac Day services, to end their day with a celebratory game of tour. Tilda Colling reports.
In the early hours of this morning, Anzac Day services began, with the last post ringing out from coast to coast. While thousands paid their respects, the day wasn't without interruption. Two welcome to countries heckled in Melbourne and Perth. After marches through CBD streets, the crowds have emptied and the bars have filled.
Hold your money, ladies and gentlemen!
Games of two-up have been played at pubs and clubs this afternoon, which in most parts of the country is illegal every day except Anzac Day.
The Governor-General has spoken at the Gallipoli Dawn service for Anzac Day, remembering the Australian and New Zealand soldiers who lost their lives 110 years ago. Thousands gathered on the Turkish coastline to mark the first major military action fought by Australia and New Zealand forces during the First World War. Governor-General Sam Mostyn has called on those gathered to remember the 11,500 Anzacs who lost their lives.
What happened here 110 years ago is a constant call not to arms, but to peace. And that is why we will remember them, lest we forget.
A forensic investigation has led to the discovery of the remains of four Australian First World War soldiers on the Western Front. The bodies have been found together in an area of northern France near the site of the Second Battle of Bullecourt in 1917. Manager of Unrecovered War Casualties, Dr. Aaron Pegram, says they now face the task of finding out who they were.
People who are descendants of these four soldiers, and we'll be able to confirm through DNA profiles that these individuals are who we think they are. But throughout that long process, it's a very rewarding experience, and hopefully having the potential to reunite these soldiers with their identities more than 100 years after they had gone missing in action.
Victoria's Premier Jacinta Allen has condemned the alleged actions of a man who police have interviewed about offensive behaviour at this morning's Anzac Day dawn service in Melbourne. During the service, attended by about 50,000 people, a small group could be heard booing and jeering loudly throughout the Welcome to Country speech by an Aboriginal elder, and at other times when the contributions of First Nations soldiers were mentioned. Ms Allen says police are dealing with a man from a far-right group who is allegedly responsible for the disrespectful behaviour.
For a neo-Nazi to come along and show that level of disrespect and dishonour to every man and woman who has served our nation with pride, honour and dignity, I absolutely condemn this behaviour. Police have subsequently identified this individual.
Meanwhile, ceremonies around the country have acknowledged the service of Indigenous people of Australia and New Zealand in conflicts around the world. In Perth, hundreds turned out to an event where a corroboree and a haka were performed, while Indigenous Australians and Māori people shared stories of the role of their people in the armed forces. Indigenous advocate Megan Cracker says the focus of the service was bringing people together.
I don't want to see any division. I want to see people be able to live their best lives. I want to see Australia where there's that inclusivity, that one where we embrace each other, brothers and sisters. That is the right thing to do.
Meanwhile, thousands of Israelis have defied police orders and taken to the streets of Tel Aviv to protest the ongoing war in Gaza. They're calling for an end to the conflict, not only to ensure the remaining 59 Israeli hostages are returned by Hamas, but also because of the devastating humanitarian crisis gripping the Strip. Many held posters saying Palestinian lives matter and photos of Gazan children killed during the war. And one of the favourites to be the next pope has led a special prayer service for the late Pope Francis ahead of his funeral at the Vatican tomorrow. Europe correspondent Mazoe Ford reports.
Cardinal Luis Antonio Tagle from the Philippines led a public prayer service for Pope Francis at Santa Maria Maggiore in Rome, the basilica where the late pontiff will be laid to rest after his funeral tomorrow. There's no clear front-runner to succeed Francis, but some bookmakers have singled out 67-year-old Cardinal Tagle, as well as Pietro Parolin from Italy, aged 70, as early favourites. The College of Cardinals will meet in conclave in the Sistine Chapel early next month to debate and then vote for their preferred candidates until a single name prevails.
This is ABC News.
Hello, welcome to PM this Anzac Day. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, around the country, Australians remember the sacrifices of our servicemen and women. We'll tell you about the discovery of the remains of four diggers killed in France in the First World War and the 14-year-old boy continuing the tradition of the last post.
It's just really special. It's like just everything freezes for a moment. You just look out there and see everyone, heads down, they're just paying all their respects. It's just a heartfelt moment.
Around Australia and overseas, millions of people have marked Anzac Day today, honouring the soldiers of this country and New Zealand who landed at Gallipoli 110 years ago and all the men and women who've served the nation since then. Solemn dawn services were followed by more jovial get-togethers in the afternoon. Miles Holbrook-Walk filed this report.
Australia rose to dawn services across the country as dignitaries and citizens paused to remember.
At the going down of the sun and in the morning, we will remember them.
Speaking at the dawn service in Brisbane, Queensland Governor Dr. Jeanette Young said 110 years after the Anzacs landed in Gallipoli, it's important to remember the sacrifice of those who have died in service.
This legacy teaches us humility and dignity. We honour Anzac Day not to glorify war, but to recognise the immense preciousness of peace.
As the sun came out, so did thousands of current and former personnel to take part in marches while cheered on by supporters, some attending the march in Darwin with familial connections to the Defence Force.
Oh, just because our dad is working in the Air Force, celebrating the country and all the people who fought in the war.
Those connections are significant for Maria Permasal from Papua New Guinea, who says it's important to her to acknowledge her own family link to World War II.
I don't know, because I was born and I had a story about my dad, my grandfather, telling a story about the war.
In the afternoon, the Anzac spirit became a little louder as punters tried their hand at two-up, a game illegal in most parts of the country on every day of the year except Anzac Day.
I think the first bet I'm willing to go, like, okay, I have a 20, and then if I lose that 20, maybe I'll be less willing the next time.
In the historical Rocks area of Sydney, many came out to socialise with fellow servicemen and women, and those who've never served came along to commemorate, many proudly donning their own or indeed their family's medals for service to the Australian Defence Force. This man served in the army and was mainly in Townsville.
What does today mean for you?
For me, it's about remembering friends that aren't here, remembering those that have come before us.
Others who haven't served were thinking of their family's contribution.
I come from five generations of servicemen and women, over a dozen family members have served, about remembering not only them but the countless men and women who've given more than they could have ever been asked for in the defence of the freedoms and the security which we now enjoy.
Brendan Carrick says he thinks even as the day gets bigger and louder with massive events at pubs and clubs, the heart of Anzac Day hasn't been lost.
And I just want to ask about the day and how big it's become, particularly in places like Sydney. I mean, this is really extraordinary, isn't it?
Yes.
What do you think of it? Are we losing sight of the heart of Anzac Day, do you think?
Not at all. I think it's easy to attack the youth for not being as engaged. But as an amateur historian, which I can say because I have my bachelor's, attacking the youth has always been a common theme throughout history. But the amount of young people here, they're very aware of the significance of the day, and many of them would have been to dawn services today. It's, honestly, it's become a much bigger thing since I was a kid, and I think even with now, with the instability we're seeing in the world, a lot of us appreciate it.
Derek Collins played his bagpipes in the Sydney Anzac March today. Though he's been doing it for decades, he still cherishes the opportunity to do his part.
To come out and watch the parade, cheer everybody on, I think it's very good. As an occasion, it starts off rather sombre in memory of those that didn't return and some that are still serving, and it also is a day to remember and catch up with friends and celebrate at the end of the day.
Australians young and old marking the significance of Anzac Day in their own way.
Moles Holbrook-Walk reporting. Overseas, crowds have gathered at several places, including Gallipoli in Turkey and Villers-Bretonneux in France, to honour the dead and all who've served our nation. Isabel Massali prepared this report.
At Anzac Cove on the Gallipoli Peninsula, silence is broken as the sun begins to rise. Australians and New Zealanders have made the journey to Turkey for this occasion, a significant anniversary of the ill-fated landing.
110 years later, we stand here at dawn to commemorate the Anzacs, remembering their bravery, courage and sacrifice.
Princess Anne addressing the crowd on behalf of King Charles.
We also remember all Australian and New Zealand men and women who since that day have served their country in wars, conflicts and peace missions. Their service is not forgotten. We will remember them.
Australian Governor-General Sam Mostyn also paid her respects, saying what happened in Gallipoli in the First World War is a constant call not to arms, but to peace.
We remember them as exceptional, and certainly there were incredible acts of extraordinary valour, stories of exceptional courage and sacrifice that have resounded the generations. But those who fought here, as you've heard this morning, were just like us. The quiet, thoughtful mate, the hard worker, the loner, the larrikin, and so many of the characters we all recognise.
In Villers-Bretonneux in northern France, able seaman and Gomeroi man Todd McGrady began the dawn service with this performance. It was soon followed by a moving speech from Australia's ambassador to France, Lynette Wood. Her grandfather, Albert, fought on the Western Front.
The First World War was a defining moment for Australia. Our federation was new. Our population, only 4 million. Yet more than 400,000 Australians volunteered to serve during the war, and some 60,000 Australians lost their lives, the highest casualty toll of any Australian contribution to a major conflict. No community in Australia was spared the impact. And I speak from personal experience.
Hours earlier, at the Australian War Memorial in Canberra, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese paid tribute to those who've lost their lives in service.
We who are gathered here think of those who went out to the battlefields of all wars but did not return. We feel them still near us in spirit. We wish to be worthy of their great sacrifice. Let us therefore once more dedicate ourselves to the ideals for which they died.
But the Prime Minister was later compelled to condemn some behaviour at other Australian dawn services. At Melbourne Shrine of Remembrance, a small group heckled and booed during the Welcome to Country as it was being delivered by Gundij Maraman, Uncle Mark Brown. Their offensive jeers were largely drowned out by applause from the crowd. But a man known to be a neo-Nazi was escorted away from the shrine by police. And at the service in Perth's King's Park, a man also yelled out during the Welcome to Country.
There is no place in Australia for what occurred. The disruption of Anzac Day is beyond contempt, and the people responsible must face the full force of the law. This was an act of low cowardice, on a day when we honour courage and sacrifice.
A position backed by opposition leader Peter Dutton.
Their actions should be condemned, and I'm sure that every right-thinking Australian would be disgusted and appalled by the behaviour, and it's not something that we tolerate in our country at all.
Aboriginal man Dean Duncan from Melbourne is a defence veteran. He says the abuse yelled out during the Welcome to Country was hurtful.
It's a day that we're proud of, particularly as Aboriginal people that we've served our country, and we do that as something that I've always wanted to do. But when you've got people who disrespect the whole of the ANZAC concept by doing that, it just erodes any positives on the day. And when you see or hear negative things around a service, you know, it does hurt.
That's Aboriginal veteran Dean Duncan, Isabel Massali, with that report. And we heard in some of Isabel's reports some of the service from the Australian National Memorial at Villers-Bretonneux in northern France. It honours the 10,719 Australian soldiers who died in France in the First World War and have no known grave. The Australian Army continues to search for their remains, and just recently four diggers were found. It's believed they died in the Second Battle of Bullecourt nearly 108 years ago in May 1917. 3,700 Australians died fighting the German forces in two battles there, and those deaths came in just 2 months that year, April and May. Historian Dr. Aaron Pegram is the manager of the Army's Unrecovered War Casualties Unit, and I asked him to first explain the job the Australians had at Bullecourt.
They managed to fight their way into the German defences without actually any support at all. And during the Second Battle of Bullecourt, which is happening in May 1917, they actually fought their way into the German trenches and held them against a whole determined series of German counterattacks that tried to eject them at every opportunity. The great sort of tragedy about Bullecourt is once, you know, Australians have expended 10,000 casualties sort of getting a toehold into the German trenches, trying to achieve this breakthrough, the whole series of operations is cancelled because the British switch their focus north to Belgium, where conditions are right to start a series of operations that then become known as the Third Battle of Ypres. So this is the First World War, a textbook First World War engagement, where even though there are some very minor successes, it ultimately does come at the cost of vast amounts of casualties.
So the four Australian soldiers who have just been found, how do you think they died?
These men were killed by a German artillery fire, which was hammering away at an Australian position along a railway embankment, which is one of the very few forms of protection in part of the Australian positions in the Bullecourt sector in 1917. And these men received a hasty battlefield burial very near that railway embankment. And that's precisely where we found them when we conducted our activity.
And how do you go about now identifying them?
This is a rigorous process where we look at a list of candidates. We take a close examination of the artefacts that were found with the men when we recovered them. And we will do a whole series of really deep historical research to try and narrow down what units were using that location at what time. And then also too, our forensic specialists will look at the skeletons themselves to try and estimate age, trying to estimate their height and potential weight, which we can then look at historical records, the individual service record that every Australian soldier completed and was filled out on his behalf when he saw service in the Australian Imperial Force. But of course, the gold standard is DNA, where hopefully we can get family reference samples from potential donors and potential sort of family members whose DNA will help unlock the key to try and identify who these men truly are.
Do many families still come forward asking you to find their loved one and perhaps offering up a DNA sample?
They do indeed. And certainly people who are descendants of Australian soldiers who are missing in action from the First World War the Second World War are more than welcome to get online and visit the Unrecovered War Casualties website, where you can fill out information that relates to your missing relative. And if that matches along with an investigation that we have got ongoing or potentially may have in the future, we can reach out to discuss the potential of sourcing DNA.
And Dr. Pegram, did these four soldiers have any artefacts, any belongings on them that you can tell us about?
They were recovered wearing Australian regimental shoulder titles on their uniforms and, of course, the iconic Rising Sun collar badge on their uniforms, which, of course, which were distinctive Australian items of kit and equipment that were on their uniform, which, of course, made them distinctly Australian from their British counterparts.
In the First World War or after the First World War, Australian soldiers were buried where they fell. Will these soldiers now be buried in one of the Commonwealth cemeteries in France?
Yeah, that's the idea, is that once we complete our investigation to try and identify who these men are, the view is that they will certainly be buried in a Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemetery nearby, near where they fell, ideally together. I mean, they've been buried together for more than a century now. It seems fitting that they remain buried together in the future. But Australian servicemen who died in the First and Second World Wars are buried overseas. And it was not until after Korea and 1964, after the initial stages of the Vietnam War, that Australian servicemen who died on operations were brought back home to Australia.
Dr. Pegram, I know you've done a lot of work in the field. What goes through your mind when you see the remains of an Australian soldier who's been buried, say, on the Western Front for more than a century?
As a historian, and I lead a team of investigators who often have a policing background and forensic specialists who have similarly a policing and science background. When you are looking at sets of remains and conducting this research, you try and be as objective as possible. But I think there are moments where you are confronted with the human face of war. It is often said that despite war's changing character, it remains an enduring human endeavour. And certainly when you're looking at death like that, more than 100 years down the track, that is certainly something that remains particularly poignant and it stays with you for some time. But I don't think there could be any greater honour than to help recover an Australian soldier who's been missing in action for more than a century and working to try and reunite him with his identity.
Dr. Aaron Pegram is the manager of the Australian Army's Unrecovered War Casualties Unit. All sorts of people make contributions to Anzac Day at all stages of life. In a moment, we'll hear from two veterans who are helping keep up the supply of emu feathers for the famous slouch hats of the Australian Light Horsemen. But first, 14-year-old musician Jordan Mansfield has been performing an important role at recent dawn ceremonies, playing the last post. He lives in Marimbula on the New South Wales south coast, and he doesn't have a bugle, so he sounds the call on his trumpet instead. Isla Evans prepared this report. The responsibility of playing the last post has fallen into younger hands.
It's just really special. It's like just everything freezes for a moment. You just look out there and see everyone, heads down, they're just paying all their respects. It's just a heartfelt moment.
In Marimbula on the New South Wales far south coast, 14-year-old Jordan Mansfield has become the town's go-to musician, committed to playing his part.
You can't really get much of it. Once in a lifetime moment, and I just can't believe I get to feel that. Yeah.
The historical call is traditionally played on a bugle, but Jordan does things a little differently.
Commonly played on a bugle, and I do not have a bugle, so I'm just going to start with the trumpet. I feel like it is easier on the trumpet because I have more experience with it.
While playing the call, the spirit of Jordan's great-grandfather, who played a role in war conflicts, is with him.
So I try to think of him whenever I play it and all the other people that lost their lives in the war.
...14-year-old Jordan Mansfield. That report from Isla Evans and Floss Adams. At Anzac Day marches around the country today, you may have spotted a slouch hat with emu feathers fluttering in the breeze. The hat with the distinctive plume was worn by the men of the Australian Light Horse, the mounted infantry unit known for their skill and bravery in the First World War. Their service is remembered by many. Our reporter Emily Doak spoke with two veterans who are helping keep up the supply of emu feathers.
The Australian Light Horse wore slouch hats adorned with emu plumes, or as some larrikin soldiers were known to call them, kangaroo feathers. Emu plumes are still worn by members of the Australian Armoured Corps today. These days, getting feathers doesn't involve catching a wild emu. It's where retired soldier and plume maker Dale Kirkman comes in.
So it's all about the fullness of the plume and some of the colour, because the tradition was the darker the feather, the better the rider for the light horse. Therefore, some of them have a darker a tinge on the end. So I try to get feathers with nice tips on them.
This niche hobby began 20 years ago when Dale was still in the army and needed a new plume for his own hat. He went to see a fellow soldier, Ian Marston, who also ran a small emu farm at The Rock in southern New South Wales.
And he said, oh, can I get some feathers? I said, oh, rightio. I said, you've got to come out and work for me, though. He said, rightio. So that relationship's now been going on for 20 years and he just makes the perfect plumes for the military and is a real professional.
What does it take to grow a good emu to have those top-notch feathers?
Well, it's nutrition as well, Emily. It's like anything, if your genetics for a start, so you don't want to have scraggly emus with hardly any feathers.
And how many feathers?
I don't know. Do you want to try and pluck one? We'll try and have a look and see how it goes.
That's emu farmer and veteran Ian Marston speaking with reporter Emily Doak in southern New South Wales. And you can watch the full story on Landline this Sunday at 12:30 on ABC TV or on iView. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Tomorrow night, the funeral of Pope Francis will be held at the Vatican. And you can listen to our coverage of the funeral mass tomorrow night from 5:30 Australian Eastern Standard Time, live on News Radio or on the ABC Listen app. The US President Donald Trump says he plans to put more pressure on Russian President Vladimir Putin to sign a peace deal to end the war in Ukraine. On social media, Mr. Trump reprimanded the Russian leader after an attack on Ukraine's capital killed 12 people. Political analysts, though, say the social media post was just a publicity stunt and Mr. Trump's relationship with Russia is as strong as ever. Kathleen O'Connor has this report.
As rescue crews clear the rubble in Kyiv after a Russian missile strike that killed 12 people, the US President Donald Trump admits ending the Russia-Ukraine war is more difficult than he anticipated. On social media, he posted an impassioned plea to his Russian counterpart, writing, "Vladimir, stop. Not necessary and very bad timing."
I didn't like last night. I wasn't happy with it. And we're in the midst of talking peace and missiles were fired. And I was not happy with it.
President Donald Trump was bombarded with questions from reporters in the Oval Office during his time with visiting Norwegian Prime Minister Jonas Gahr Støre. Many asked if he's putting enough pressure on Russia to sign the peace plan.
We're putting a lot of pressure on Russia. And Russia knows that, and some people that are close to it know, or he wouldn't be talking right now. I think he wants to make a deal. We're going to find out very soon, but it takes two to tango.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says Ukraine has agreed to an unconditional ceasefire and has accused the US of not putting strong pressure on Russia to do the same.
We have been attacked, our territory occupied, tens of thousands of people killed, many children and adults buried alive. And the fact that Ukraine is ready to sit at a negotiating table with the terrorists that did it all on our land, this is a great compromise.
Wesley Widmyer is a professor of international relations at the Australian National University. He criticised Donald Trump's social media post saying Russia and Ukraine are nowhere near a peace deal.
What Trump is pushing for with respect to the Russians is not a peace plan. Just a ceasefire. If you're looking at the substantive moves taken by the United States, I wouldn't put too much stock in a Truth Social post.
Professor Widmyer says while Donald Trump's post seems to turn the heat up on the Russian leader to sign a peace deal, his actions prove otherwise.
A tweet or a Truth Social post that may look like he's, you know, wrapping Ukraine's knuckles, but the whole strategic context is just so overwhelmingly generous to Putin and the Russians that it's difficult to see it as more than something that's performative. They are pretty clearly favoring the Russian side. This is not peace negotiation or treaty negotiations. This is for a ceasefire. It's the least he could do. If one were serious, about, you know, trying to get some kind of negotiated settlement, one would not make so many preemptive concessions.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says the US and Moscow are moving in the right direction for peace in Ukraine. But Professor Widmeyer says another Russian attack on Kyiv could risk the entire deal.
So in terms of where we go from here, Trump and Rubio have threatened to walk away. It's possible, I suppose, that they do walk away, although whether that's an art of the deal styled posturing, I don't know. But right now, in terms of the correlation of forces, if you're looking at negotiations are usually some combination of carrot and sticks. And, you know, all the carrots are being given to the Russians.
Professor Wesley Widmeyer from the ANU, Kathleen O'Connor reporting. And that's PM for this week. I'm Samantha Donovan. I hope you have a good weekend. Good night.
ABC Radio National.
Welcome to Media Land, your weekly look at what's happening behind the scenes and on your screens. I'm Tim Burrows.
And I'm Vivian Kelly.
Viv, not much doubt about the media's big news story of the week with the death of Pope Francis.
Yes, it seems we've swapped out Trump stories for J.D. Vance killed the Pope memes.
Coming up, we'll take a look at how the media covered the death of the pontiff. It was unfortunate timing for some. But first, Viv, it's been a crucial week for Google and Meta, with two separate cases being heard in court in the US, both raising the question of breaking them up. What do you think when I mention Google, Viv?
Well, it's more than a company and more than a search engine, Tim. It's a verb in and of itself. When you need to find something out or settle a debate at a pub or find out who that actor was that you saw on that show, you don't search engine it, you Google it, with the exception of that one friend that we all have who refuses to use Google.
That one loser friend who uses Bing. And certainly that is, I think, what most people do think about when they think of Google. They think about search. But the facts of the matter is it's about so much more than that. If you're on a website and you see ads on it, chances are they're probably powered by Google. If you use Chrome, that's them. They own YouTube too. If you have Android, you're part